Yeah, so David asked me to talk about interneurons, and luckily that's what we've been working on for the last few years, so I'll have something to say. I'm not a physicist or a mathematician, and I thought just for a change this week I'd give a data-rich talk and a theory-poor talk. So what I'm going to do is go through some work that we've been doing over the last several years on the cortex, and it sounds like a number of people here are interested in the cortex. I'm going to focus on the inhibitory interneurons of the cortex, and in particular, two types that we've studied extensively. I'm going to start by telling you about the chemical synaptic connections between the cells. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how they're connected, which cells are connected to which, and something about the strength and the dynamics and the properties of those connections. But probably the larger part of the talk will be about electrical synapses, which is something we've been studying for about 3 years now, and something that we stumbled into, and that I think has become a pretty interesting issue. Again, I'll tell you who's connected to whom, how they're connected, and how strongly. I'll tell you a little bit about what protein is involved in making that connection. And with any luck, we'll have time to get on to what might be some of the implications of these electrical as well as chemical connections between inhibitory cells. All right, and I don't have to tell anybody here that they can please stop me any time. And I everybody except Kleinfeld can stop me. Save all your questions for the end. In his absence. Okay, so it sounds like a lot of people know about the cortex. Hard to know where to start, but I'll start here. So most of you know that the cortex has two basic kinds of cells, excitatory and inhibitory cells. And this is a little picture I like to use that I stole from a review by Kawaguchi. Yes?
Isn't there a claim, right, that the cell is either excitatory or inhibitory? Is it actually true?
It's a fair point. And in the cortex, I would say that as far as anybody knows, it's about as true as it is anywhere else. And we could discuss this, but yeah.
So just to talk about the other animals, so in invertebrates, right? And sometimes you see calling F plus inhibitory and excitatory transferring. But I think
that could be true in mammals as well.
Yeah, I think that maybe a more general idea is that whatever neurotransmitter is given off in one terminal is given off at all terminals.
Well, that would be, he said Dale's law, and that's closer to Dale's law than anything to do with excitation or inhibition.
So Dale's law is more related to the type of neurotransmitter than to the effect?
I think Dale's law was specifically about the neurotransmitter, had nothing to do with the effect. It was just it was a statement about what was released, and that if I'm a cell and I make a synapse here and I make a synapse here, they both release the same thing. As far as I know, in the cortex, that's true. Dale's law holds. With several new spins on it, like I think it was my first sentence. So now I'm going to qualify everything I said in that sentence.
You said everybody knows, and I want to just.
Okay. I'm sorry. Well, let me change it. Let me change the statement. Let me change the statement a little bit. So the blue cells, as far as anybody knows, release glutamate as their transmitter. Glutamate anywhere in the cortex tends to be excitatory, at least on the postsynaptic side. So I'm going to make the assumption that these are excitatory cells. The red cells all release GABA as their transmitter, as their primary transmitter. Some of them release peptides as well. GABA in the cortex, with rare experimental exceptions, tends to be an inhibitory substance. So now, as a shorthand, I'll call the blue cells excitatory and the red cells inhibitory. And we'll forget about the excitatory cells for the most part. And I'll talk about the red cells. And the first thing you need to know, the additional thing you need to know, is that although the red cells are the minority type in the cortex, they range anywhere from 15 to, say, 30% of all the neurons in the cortex, there are many different types of inhibitory cells. So, and in fact, how many types is open to debate depends which lab is doing the talking, what criteria you use. And so this diagram shows just a smattering of some of the more major types that you'll come across. Basket cells are probably the most common in the cortex. They're called basket cells because you can classify these cells by a whole variety of criteria. Classically, they're defined by their morphology, and it turns out the axon shape is more predictive of type than the soma and dendritic shape. They're also defined by their transmitters or by the proteins they express. It's easier to say. So, you know, this cell expresses somatostatin, which is a small peptide that's active on neurons. These kind express a certain kind of calcium binding protein called parvalbumin. And other proteins are specific for other types. And they're different also, as I'll show you, in their electrophysiology and their ability to generate action potential patterns. And in fact, they're different in about every way that you can measure. They vary across areas, they vary across layers. So the question of what is a cell type is a sort of complicated one that I don't really want to go down that road today. So it's enough to know that there are many types. What I'm going to do is show you data that we've acquired mostly by this fairly standard technique these days, where you take, in our case, a mouse or a rat. You can make a slice through its brain, and what we tend to do for these experiments is slice it at a funny rotated oblique angle that retains a big chunk of the cortex as well as the thalamus and a lot of the connections between the two. So it's a bit more of a circuit than you typically get in a brain slice in vitro. So this is from a mouse, and you can see here, I don't know if it's clear to everybody, but you can see some of the layers. This is under infrared DIC optics, very standard stuff. You can see some dark and light banding. You can see here that turns out to be layer 4, that there are actually discrete little, what the field knows as barrels, clusters of cells that are distinct from one another, and that this is not what I'm going to talk about today, but that correspond to the map of the major whiskers on the face. So this is the primary somatosensory cortex of the rodent, and this is the part of it that deals primarily with the information from the whiskers that the animal uses as such an important sensory modality. And David, I'm sure, will talk about
just
this.
Just to remind us, I mean, when you make the slice, you preserve connections going in both directions.
Yes. Yeah, and I could talk more about that later, but I didn't really work it into the talk. But yeah, so it is important to know for the people who don't know about the cortex that, first of all, the thalamus, as far as sensory systems go, the thalamus is the major target of ascending information. They synapse on these so-called relay cells. The relay cells send axons up into the cortex, and so they are the major source of input to the cortex, non-cortical input anyway. And there are axons that also go back from cortex to thalamus. Now, the experiments, the data that I'll show you today come from, again, a very fairly standard and straightforward approach now, which is to use visualized whole cell and two or three cell simultaneous recordings. And that's what you see on the top there. So you see the cell bodies of two inhibitory interneurons. And the little pipette cartoons. And most of what I'll show you is based on recording from two cells at once and looking at the interactions between them, either chemical or electrical, synaptic. Almost everything I'll tell you was based on recordings only in layer 4. So in order to begin to simplify this problem that the cortex has so many layers and so many connections and certainly so many interneuron types, we've put most of our attention into layer 4. Layer 4 in this system is the main target of input. So the relay cells down here send their axons up, and they most densely synapse onto cells within layer 4. So we're trying to look at the first stage of processing in this cortex. The other beauty of layer 4 is that it has its excitatory cells, those blue cells, unlike other layers, tend to be very small and roundish, whereas most of the inhibitory cells are larger and have often these oblique and strange shapes.
When you say large, you mean cell body?
The cell body, yeah. So it's a practical place to look for interneurons and study them, because you get down, and the way you do the experiment is you put the slice in there, you look through the microscope, you scan around, and you see these cell bodies, And with experience, you get to know which cell type looks like what, how big it is, its shape. And if you want to study a particular kind of interneuron, you, because they're the minority of cells, you want to maximize the chances that your pipette will hit the cell you want. And that's easier to do in layer 4 than, in our experience, than it is in other places. So they're both practical as well as, I think, rational reasons for targeting layer 4. Okay, I told you there are many types of interneurons. From now on, I'm going to talk only about two types. And again, without getting into a big debate about what's a type, I will argue that at least within layer 4 in this animal, in this part of cortex, there are two major classes of inhibitory cells. And there's no standard nomenclature in the field, but this is mine for these two cells. The most common type, in fact, if anybody agrees on anything, if people agree on anything, it's that the major type of interneuron is similar to the one on the left. And I call it a fast-spiking cell, and a number of other labs do, but people have other names for it.
This would be a basket cell, then?
So many of these are basket cells, but probably some of them are also these axoaxonic cells that I didn't talk about. A key feature of them is that the vast majority, if not all of them, stain for parvalbumin, this calcium binding protein, which seems to be in that type and not others, as far as I know. In layer 4 of our cortex, the green there is not a very good picture, but the green is the reconstruction of the axon of the cell, and most of these cells tend to have a vertical orientation like that, to the axonal arbor. They're called fast spiking because their action potentials, are very brief. In fact, they're the quickest action potentials that you can find in the cortex, certainly. And it's harder to find quicker action potentials anywhere else in the brain, with the possible exception of the Renshaw cells. I'll show you a picture later, but if you simply look at the width of the action potential in time, it's short.
Number?
Oh, the number. Well under a millisecond. Half a millisecond to 750 microseconds, something like that. And that's quite a bit quicker than most other action potentials you find in the cortex, at least. They're also fast in the sense that they can fire at high rates. If in this case we're looking at a recording from one and simply putting steps of current in, there are a number of interesting features to the way they fire that I'm not going to dwell on today. But one thing you can do is fire them at very high rates. And unlike virtually all the other cells in the cortex, these tend to they fire repetitively with very little adaptation, sometimes no adaptation. Sometimes, in fact, they accelerate a little bit. So you can see this thing is ripping along at high rate and maintaining that for a long time. There are other interesting features like this. If you stimulate them right around threshold, they often have this very long delay to the first spike. And then when they start spiking, they spike repetitively. It's Hodgkin type 2 cell for the aficionados. So that's the fast spiking cell. And they are probably the majority. Maybe they account for roughly half of all interneurons in layer 4. It's hard to get statistics on this. The other kind of cell I'm going to talk about is, I'm going to call it the low threshold spiking cell, or the LTS cell. And the name is unfortunate, but again, I didn't name it. Kawaguchi named it, and now he doesn't even use that name anymore, but we're sticking with it. Other people have other names for it. The Zachman lab, I think, likes to call these, probably the same kind of cell they call a bituffed cell. But they work in a different layer, so it's hard to know exactly whether we're looking at a corresponding cell. But suffice to say that the LTS cells are distinct from these cells in that they have a broader action potential, more than a millisecond generally. They can spike fast, but they adapt, unlike the fast spiking cells. They have much more prominent adaptation. They don't have this long delay to the first spike if you hold them near threshold. And unlike the fast spiking cells, they stain for a different calcium binding protein, calbindin. And they also often, or maybe always, have somatostatin in them, this small peptide, which is probably co-released with GABA, although that's not a very well-studied issue. So I don't think Dale anticipated the release of two transmitters, but that's pretty well established in many, many cells in the brain. And often it's a small amino acid like GABA, along with a larger peptide, and they're differentially packaged and actually in the well-studied systems, it takes different patterns of stimulation to release the amino acid as compared to the peptide. But that's all by analogy to other places.
Is that known what accounts for the absence of resistance, the delay?
Well, what accounts for the presence of it would be probably the more interesting question. And no, as far as I know, no one's studied that issue in these cells. There are other cells in the brain that show a long delay like this. I think the most straightforward way to get it, and this has been shown in a number of systems, is that you need some slowly inactivating potassium current. You want to give a different explanation?
No, sorry. This is a personal
edge. All the better.
It doesn't look like IAP.
I'm not saying that, not A, but something analogous to A, with much slower kinetics. And these exist. So Johann Storm has something he calls decurrent, he described years ago. Yeah, so, and you know, there's this great ball and chain model that you can change the kinetics by whether you believe it or not. But let me give this explanation, maybe you have an alternative one. No, it's okay, this is good. The idea is that, if you depolarize the cell and you activate this strong potassium current, that's going to hold it sub-threshold for a while. But then as the potassium current inactivates, it's not too obvious from this one, but very often you see a slow ramp up of the voltage, and then it reaches threshold and it starts spiking.
Well, either one. And that's what I'm shaking my head about.
What was the other one?
Well, any of those currents should have a ramp up. That's what I was shaking my head about.
You didn't see the ramp. Yeah, actually somewhere in this pile there. There's a good picture of a ramp. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So the bottom line is, I'm going to talk about these two kinds of interneurons. Yes.
When you say very fast, can you?
Fast what?
Fast like the rate. Fast
the rate?
300.
Well, yeah, 300. I first studied these when I was a postdoc. Dave McCormick and I studied them in interface slices at 37 degrees with sharp electrodes, and you could get these things to go at 600, 700 if you really pushed, for brief periods at least. But here the experiments are done at a little cooler temperature, 34, submerged slice. The conditions are different and maybe not quite as conducive to, you know, maximal performance, but you didn't hear me say that. Yeah.
I mean, to me, it doesn't really seem to be very different. The dynamics of these cells doesn't seem to be very different. The right one just looks like what you have to, because it also shows a little bit of adaptation. And if you add another current, which balances this adaptation, you would get something which is not adapting.
Okay, well, all you're telling me is that they
would expect this delay, because it would have...
All you're telling me is that they probably express different kinds of channels, different...
I think
it would take more than that. If and when I show you the action potentials, you see that the action potentials are...
So there's another criterion, which is the size of the action.
Yeah, the single action potentials are distinctly different, too. And there are other features that I'm not going to talk about, because I'll never get to see them.
It seems at first sight that you just need one parameter more, and then you're done.
Well, I don't think that's true. You probably need several, but that, whether it's one or five, I don't... Yeah. All right, let's try to get on to connections. So what I really want to do is talk about the interactions between the two kinds of cells by synaptic connections. So you do these pairwise recordings, and the first question we're going to ask is, if we just sample from pairs of cells of different combinations, how often are they connected and how strongly are they connected? So I told you these are inhibitory cells, and I'm going to often use these little icons, blue for fast spike and green for LTS. So these are just a couple of examples. These are actually two different pairs. And they make the point that, well, first of all, the two cells are inhibitory because they're generating. And here's the other convention. So these are paired recordings, simultaneous recordings. Here we inject a little bit of a current pulse to cause one spike in the FS cell. And we look at the output. We look at the response in the LTS cell. So. Spike here gives you a nice IPSP here, and this is just many trials overlaid. You can see the variability. The other thing to key into is that the gains will often be different. So the gain is very low on the top because it's a spike, and the gain is very high on the bottom because it's a unitary IPSP, that is an IPSP generated by one cell. So this slide makes the point that A, the cells are indeed inhibitory, and I can tell you that we can block this with GABA-A antagonists, and that goes totally away. So it's mediated by GABA-A receptors. It's chloride dependent. It's a standard plain vanilla inhibitory postsynaptic potential. The other point it makes is that FS cells connect to LTS cells, and I'll tell you they do that commonly, a lot. And likewise, on the other hand, LTS also connects back to FS cells. So the two cell types innervate one another pretty heavily. It's also true that the FS cells innervate themselves a lot. By themselves, I don't mean autaptically, although they probably do that too. But a pair of FS cells very often innervates. You often find a connection there as well. And that's one of the differences, another difference between the two systems, because LTS cells pretty rarely innervate one another.
But when you find a connected pair, you're saying that there's a very high chance that any two pairs are interconnected or just say within the population. Is it reciprocal? So if I find an FS connected, on that one, I stimulate it back.
Actually, they seem to vary independently. I mean, we look for that. If a cell connects one way, is it more likely to connect the other way? And the answer seems to be no, at least statistically.
And the other thing is just more, the test you said before, FS cells is higher than LTS.
Yes, yeah. And I don't remember the numbers, but.
I think by a little bit, it's not an order of magnitude, it can be a few tenths of a percent.
So I'm thinking that this is an inhibitory network, not many LTS cells with a few FS cells, so it's not excitatory because it's double inhibitory. You don't think of networks where you have many LTS cells and a few FS cells, so LTS to LTS becomes not excitatory.
No, LTS barrier.
I'm going to get LTS tends not to connect to LTS. I'll show you a summary diagram that will bring all this home. Okay, so we can count the probabilities that cells will be connected to one another. We can also look at the strength of the connections, and that turns out to be important to do because it varies tremendously. And again, this gives us a clear distinction between the two types of cells. So this comes from these, So we're still doing pairwise recordings. Now I have to introduce the third type of cell that I haven't mentioned yet, and that is the excitatory cell. So there are many excitatory cells in there. And that's important because they are the major source of input to these cells. So often you can do a record from a pair that consists of one of these pinkish-orange cells. It's labeled RS for regular spiking because, and again, this is ancient nomenclature of Mountcastles, actually. RS is my physiological name for the excitatory cell. So now we're looking at pairs of cells that consist of an excitatory cell and one of the inhibitory cells. And you do the same experiment. You evoke a spike in the excitatory cell, and you look at the response in the inhibitory cell. And what you find is that, on average, the size of the EPSPs onto the fast-spiking cells is very strong compared to what you generally see in the LTS cells. In fact, many of the LTS cells seem to have they almost seem to be disconnected if you simply stimulate them a few times. I'll show you why that is in a minute. Not only is the strength different, but the probability of getting a response is quite different. So you can do, I know a number of you heard Chuck Stevens talk on Monday, so a lot of this will be simple review, but if you activate this cell at a low rate many times, you can count the failure rate or the success rate of EPSPs. And what you find is that for LTS cells, not only are the responses very small, but you also see a huge number of failures often. And this shows you data for a large set of cells. I'm going to get to that in a second. Yeah. Right. So at this point, the point is that you get strong excitatory inputs to the FS cells, weak and improbable inputs to the LTS cells. 34 degrees. Now we're looking at the output of the inhibitory cells onto that excitatory cell. Okay, so it's just a simple, both of these, you can imagine that both of these inhibitory cells form little feedback loops onto the excitatory cells. So here's the input to that loop, and here's the output from that loop. And the bottom line is that the same principle holds. It's not quite as dramatic here, but the fast-spiking cells evoke iPSPs in the excitatory cells that tend to be very strong and very reliable, and much more so than the strength and the reliability of the LTS cells.
Those are single ones?
Sure. Each of those is a single trial, yeah. Single.
Each one of those traces.
Each is a single trial. So this would be, I don't know, 30, 40 action potentials in the responses.
That the whole picture is 30, 40, but each one is a single one. You don't, there's no averaging making any one.
These are all single trials, right?
Okay.
Yeah, from a single pair
of
cells.
Yeah, I just wanted to see if the probability was factored into that or not.
Yeah. And actually, the failures are not shown in this picture. Sorry? None of these are failures. Yeah. Yeah, it's usually, well, so this is about as, you know, these are fairly small, and those would be, so that's my one example in these pictures of failures.
Pretty small signal to noise.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you're always going to, there's always some slop in the measure of the failure rates, because some of the events are very small. But the big point I want to make is that these two groups of interneurons have different properties, different strengths, as we'll see, dynamics to their synaptic connections. And, all right, so this is just a summary of the anatomy, the sort of physiological anatomy. If we do all these pairwise recordings, I told you this in words, but we have the two kinds of interneurons and the excitatory cell. And this is just telling you now what the odds are that a pair of that type will have a synaptic connection. And this is all recorded within a local domain of, say, usually they're within 50 microns of each other. So this is on a very local scale. And there are a lot of numbers here, but it's enough to say that the odds that two cells are going to be connected is very high unless those two cells happen to be both LTS cells. The LTS cell network is not well connected. In fact, that number of 0.09 is probably an overestimate. This is an old slide, and we have many more recordings now, and they rarely connect. Yeah. Klaus?
These numbers make sense if you give the number for the distance between them.
Right. This does not. This is only for very close cells.
What do you see under the microscope?
Close means no, probably even closer than that. So this is within. The most distant ones here are maybe 75 microns apart. Most of them are 50 microns or less. Some of them are almost touching. So yeah, the distance issue, I don't have it for these synaptic connections. I'll get to it later for the electrical connections, but it's a lot of work. Carrie, you wanted to...
I see that FS, okay, I was just trying to interpret that.
Yeah, so these you can talk about the directionality of it. These, of course, can't.
You're trying to use least number of spots necessary.
I tried. It's not on here, but interestingly enough, the connections between the RS cells were pretty sparse. And, well, we could talk about that, but I'm focusing on the interneurons. This is in layer 4. It turns out that, and some nice work has been coming out of Sockman's lab recently, which shows that on the excitatory cells, within a barrel, if you take two cells within a barrel, the connectivity rates are very high. And as soon as you get two excitatory cells that are in different barrels, it drops to zero.
But your range is within a barrel, or most people within a barrel.
Yeah, but in this study, we didn't take account of barrel borders, and so we're often wandering across between, and we just didn't deal with the barrels. Well, it's a practice. Who was doing that? You?
Sorry.
You asked for it. No, it's after the fact, but B, there's another problem, which is that the slice is about 400 microns thick, and the angle that we take the cut is the least optimal angle for separating barrels, and I mean, I could give you the whole geometry of it, but it's not worth it.
Now, this is still cylindrical slices?
Yeah.
They're kind of like across, right? Across.
They tend to go, they tend to cut within the plane of the rows. And this is, but kind of obliquely across the rows. And this is part of the problem. So a 400, the barrels are at most, what, 300 microns in diameter. The slice is 400. It's cutting across a field of cylinders, and of course you get parts of cylinders. And
no, if you are interested only in studying cortex, not tramocortical connection.
I didn't say that. Okay, so I'm going to show you.
No, if you only study, just for, let's say, doing that, so use the tramocortical slices because in the same experiment you want to study also the tramocortical connection.
Awesome.
Otherwise,
yeah. Yeah, it's the next slide.
I think there's maybe in the case to say, why don't you make a tangential slice through it?
A tangential slice.
I didn't say tangential. Yeah.
Parallel to the. Well, that's what Gutnick does.
What?
That's what Gutnick, Mike Gutnick does, or it used to do. Yeah, because we wanted to look at thalamic connections. That's why we cut it this way. And in fact, yeah, it was the next one. So I showed you that the inhibitory cells get a lot of input from the local circuit. The excitatory cells in layer 4 synapse strongly and often onto the inhibitory cells. But I also told you that the thalamus is the major source of external input to the cortex, so it's a fair question. Oh, and we've known for many decades that if you stimulate the thalamus and look in the cortex, one of the most prominent things you see is a very rapid and strong wave of inhibition. You'd expect the thalamus to excite the cortex, and it does, but it also very rapidly engages inhibition. There's been a lot of reason to think that there's a feed-forward inhibitory pathway. So we can ask the question, which of these two types of cells, if any, is the mediator of that? And it turns out that the fast-spiking cells seem to be quite clearly the best candidate for mediating a feed-forward inhibition. And that's because if you record from the three types of cells up in the cortex and you stimulate thalamic axons, this is done by external stimulation, not paired cell recording, and you do the experiment in the way that Chuck described on Monday, where you try as much as possible to activate a single axon that impinges on these cells, now you can measure, first of all, what's the likelihood that you're going to get a connection to the cell, and second of all, actually more reliably, what's the strength of that connection? And the answer is pretty clear. The fast-spiking cells get the lion's share of direct input from the thalamus. In fact, some of these connections are monstrous by the scale of things that we're used to in the cortex. And some of them go up to 10 millivolts or more. And this is, we believe, the response to the activation of a single axon. It's a very rapid connection. It's a very, again, dynamically very reliable connection. I'll talk about that in a second. And it's tremendously different from what you see in the LTS cells. The vast majority of the LTS cells don't have any demonstrable thalamic input. You can crank the stimulus current up and you just don't get anything that's monosynaptic. The few that do get it have a very weak connection. And in fact, this is an example of the strongest LTS connection we saw. So here you can see some failures too. So conclusion is most of the input from thalamus monosynaptically hits the fast-spiking cells.
I'm still unclear on how you standardize this experiment.
So the question is, yeah, what we're trying to do is a minimal stimulation protocol so that we activate a single axon. And I think this is a very conservative protocol. We're not looking at probabilities of release.
Each time for each cell, if you were an NFS, you started at the bottom and you moved up.
Right. So you get it to the point.
If you went then and said experiment got an LTS, you wouldn't keep that stimulation.
No, I wouldn't. You'd search around for another axon that hit that cell, right. And you look for a stimulus, and you find the threshold.
But since I see inhibition, you must be stimulating. When you're in that echo, I see inhibition.
Yeah, on a few trials. Right.
You must be stimulating much other axons.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not trying to say I'm stimulating just that one. But I am trying to say that I'm stimulating just one that contacts the cell we record from. Okay.
Those averages on the right are factoring in failures?
No.
Or not factoring?
Those are failures excluded, just to give you some sense. Oh, yeah, I should also mention that the excitatory cells get input too. If only the inhibitory cells got input from the thalamus, it would be odd.
I see all that noisy stuff underneath. But I assume that's the spontaneous PSP inputs to the.
Yeah.
No, there could be a.
You're talking about this stuff?
No, I'm talking about the FM. So,
these, yeah.
Those are spontaneous.
Yes.
So what makes you think that was a single fiber?
The fact that you could find, I can't, I mean, you know all the arguments for these.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm asking the question.
The logic is that if you find a stimulus threshold at which you get very clear all or none responses, and you look at the amplitude histogram of this thing, and you know, especially for these large ones, it's
let me ask you, if you draw on PTX,
all goes away.
It all goes away. So those are not mini. The spontaneous stuff.
Oh.
Are they mini? What are those? Are those single mini spontaneous quanta, or are they due to spontaneous firing of the relay cell?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's a totally different issue from this.
Sorry.
but you can see minis. And in fact, TTX blocks a surprisingly small fraction of the spontaneous synaptic events.
Spontaneous firing in the relay.
Not necessarily. Oh, no. I mean, this blue cell is getting most of his input from the local cortical circuit, actually. People have counted these things, and at least in the visual cortex, and the thalamus supplies, even in layer 4, which is the main input layer, maybe 10% of the synapses on an excitatory cell. I don't know about the inhibitory cells, but the thalamus supplies a very small fraction of the total excitatory input to layer 4. So probably most of the spontaneous stuff comes from cortical sources. Well, in the fast-spiking cells, yeah.
16 millivolts means that it brings it to a threshold, or almost a threshold?
What was the first word?
16 millivolts.
Probably in this cell, no. The thresholds are quite high in the fast-spiking cells, especially with this long delay period. I mean, you need to hit them hard to get them to spike. Okay, so the last part of the chemical synaptic part of the talk is the dynamic features of this. And I don't want to dwell on this because we haven't studied it in detail. Other people have. Alex Thompson, Henry Markram, Bert Sockman's lab, and a variety of others. But I do want to put this two interneuron system into the context of dynamics, because it's another thing that dramatically separates or distinguishes the two. So here's starting to build up the little circuit diagram. Right, here's thalamus in the FS cell. That's an FS cell. And again, they're getting input from both thalamus and cortex. And now, I told you that these are strong and reliable with single stimuli. And then just as Chuck talked about on Monday, these are standard synapses in the sense that because they're strong and reliable, you might expect them to be also strongly depressing, and they are. So here's stimulating the thalamic pathway, and you can see just how strongly this thing depresses when you stimulate it at about 40 hertz, I think, in this case. The interesting thing is that, once again, if you look at the output from the inhibitory cell onto the excitatory cell, so now we're looking at the iPSPs, this system is, again, strong and reliable, but shows a fairly prominent depression when you stimulate it repetitively. So the whole system is fairly strong and reliable, but also depressing if you activate it at high frequency. And the interesting thing is the contrast with the LTS system. So I told you that the connections there tend to be weak and unreliable when you hit them with single stimuli. But if you stimulate them repetitively, you get really dramatic facilitation on the input side and pretty prominent, not quite as dramatic, in facilitation on the output side. So dynamically, these two systems of inhibition are totally different. They're sitting in the same place. They're coextensive systems of inhibition. They're inhibiting the same cells, namely the excitatory cells in layer 4. And yet, this would seem like a good place for a good theory. Dynamically, they're totally different. Okay. I just wanted to show you an example of how this expresses itself. I've been very intrigued by just the magnitude of facilitation over here, and the fact that it has interesting kinetics too. It comes on very slowly. But this is what this is an interesting expression of that. So the experiment here is to record from an LTS cell and an excitatory cell. And now we're stimulating to kind of hunt around. You stimulate extracellularly, and you drive excitation onto the LTS cell system. And you start at low frequency. So we're looking down here, and if we stimulate these axons, we get EPSPs in both places. And you see what I showed you in the last slide. So the excitatory cell gets an EPSP, and it depresses at 5 hertz a little bit. The LTS cell gets very little input at all. It's starting to come on a little bit toward the end. Now you stimulate faster at 20 hertz, and depression is stronger here, and facilitation is stronger here. And you can just begin to see this whole thing switching from excitation to inhibition. And then at higher frequencies where the LTS system really begins to kick in, you can see that the excitatory cell is transiently excited and then strongly inhibited via this facilitating LTS system. So the LTS system looks like...
Now you're recording from a small circuit.
This is a small circuit, yeah.
So there's both an LTS and an RA circuit, and you're stimulating...
And we're stimulating multiple input axons, probably.
Yeah.
It's a crude experiment on the base, compared to the previous ones. So, but it does demonstrate this feature of the LTS system, that it only comes on under... You need more provocation. You need to stimulate fast. You need to stimulate for a while, and then it kicks in, which suggests that maybe it's not all that important for, say, fast sensory transformations.
I'm looking at this and I'm thinking exactly the opposite, because behavioral. I mean, there is a rat before the rat gave up its life, and behaviorally she'll palpate an object 3-4 times, not 10 mm-hmm. times, but not one time.
Well, that could be. And then presumably some kind of discrimination or decision is made after several trials. And,
yeah. And then there's also,
so you expect something like this to be building up in that time. Yeah,
there's
possible.
There's also a Hood's massage data, which is that you reach a, you find out that the latency in layer 5 is dependent on the stimulation frequency, but that's mm-hmm. a steady state result.
Mm-hmm.
It's 4 or 5 stimuli.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Any more systems level.
So I spoke a little too fast. I didn't mean to exclude this from anything interesting. But
I would say the opposite. It seems to be at the
heart. I was thinking for the very fastest single trial kinds of sensory things, where a classic Hubel and Weasel experiment where you flash a bar at a particular orientation.
For baseball, maybe it's not relevant.
Yeah. No, that's great. I can we could spin all sorts of possibilities here. Another thing that I like to that I wonder about is whether these are. I'm very interested in epilepsy and seizures and what causes them, what prevents them. It turns out that there's some interesting evidence that somatostatin-positive interneurons are selectively killed in certain models of epilepsy. And you can imagine that maybe one of the things this system does is serve as a break on, maybe some kind of gain controller or a fail-safe system. If activity gets to too high a frequency for too long a time and borders on the seizure mode, then this system of inhibition will kick in very strongly and tend to suppress that tendency. But again, just an idea.
The inhibition you get there in the RS cell, these two figures make it really suggestive that it comes from the LTS cell. Really
yeah, I don't know it. No, in this experiment, I don't know it. I'm inferring it from the timing and the tendencies for facilitation to match the onset of the inhibition. Yeah.
Just before you go past this, is from your lab or from any other lab, is there anything known about long-term plasticity that you used to have?
I don't think anybody has demonstrated it in these systems, in these cells. There is some evidence in hippocampus for long-term plasticity and inhibitory synapses. Even in slices now. Yeah. So it's a possibility. Hasn't been studied here. All right, so this is a summary of part one. Just what we said, the two systems of inhibition, very different dynamics and connectivity. From cortex to thalamus. I'll talk about it a little bit later, just a little bit. I'm only talking about layer 4 here. Most of the feedback from cortex comes from layer 6. What I'll do later is talk about some of the inhibitory cells in the thalamus, which are stimulated by those. But Did you have a specific question, or because
the diagram is very suggestive of the feed-forward system, which does not prove.
Well, first of all, this diagram summarizes. This is not a model of cortex. Okay. This is a model of what I told you in the last 10 slides or so, and excludes 98% of the circuitry. But the main points are that there's feed-forward inhibition via these cells. There's feedback inhibition via both kinds of cells, and there's inhibition within the FS system, but not the LTS system. So that's the idea of this. Okay, so that's electric. That's chemical synapses. Yes.
The functional properties of these cells. What would these cells be doing? I don't know much about rats.
So I'm not sure exactly what you mean by what they're doing. The short answer is we don't know. We know a little bit about the fast spiking cell. So here are the practicalities of doing an experiment in a whole rat or a mouse. First of all, intracellular recording is hard. It's not impossible, and we've done some. But the typical experiment is done by extracellular recording. And it turns out you can distinguish the fast spiking cells in extracellular recordings from all the others. And so people like Dan Simons at Pittsburgh have studied fast spiking cells as opposed to the excitatory cells. And they know something about their receptive field properties and when they're turned on and not. No one has studied the LTS cells because there's no real way to distinguish them from the other cells. There are action potentials when you record them with a standard extracellular electrode look just like excitatory cells, so you'd never be able to tell them apart. Plus, they're fairly sparse. There's no good marker for them. No way to identify them. Yep. These would be great questions, and piriform cortex and hippocampus they all have what seem to be analogs to these types of cells. There are some differences, and we could argue about whether they're... But these cells are not just in layer 4. I should make that clear. These are not layer 4 cells. These cells...
They are distinct in that what you're looking at is a place where there's a sensory projection going into cortex. It just doesn't happen in olfactory cortex.
Well, there is a sensory projection into the cortex. It doesn't come from the thalamus, right? Yeah. But there probably are analogous. In the hippocampus, that's where it's been studied best. And again, how you classify hippocampal interneurons is a big area, too. But there are somatostatin-positive cells that have some of the physiological features of these in the hippocampus. And there certainly are fast-spiking cells that have the features of these in the hippocampus. So. And there is some work. There's very little work on the LTS type of cells anywhere, because not even any agreement about that they are a distinct class that we can generalize across cortical areas about.
So. To move on here, to carry your question forward, you know what the FS firing rates are in vivo and wandering around.
Yes. Yeah.
Are the spontaneous rates when it doesn't even seem to be caring about anything in the world? Are they so high that synapse is mostly depressed, or are they so low that synapse?
Well, that's a good question, and we were talking about this Monday. We should do that kind of experiment that Chuck was talking about.
From Dan Simons.
Yeah, Simons and a few other people have.
An active animal.
Excuse me.
Anesthetized. They're paralyzed or immobile.
Yeah, Simons' stuff is from. Right. Although there are some other examples now. So Ann Grabiel's lab has a couple of papers where they looked at fast spiking cells in prefrontal cortex of behaving monkeys. And they've done, they've done their...
They reconstruct...
Their working memory tasks. Grabiel? Not Grabiel, I'm sorry. Pat Goldman. Pat Goldman or Keech.
I mean, just because you get a very narrow extracellular signal.
The argument is based on the spike shape and duration.
And you get hundreds of hertz?
So, to try and get at the answer, these cells do fire at very high rates for very brief periods of time. And again, it, Harvey Swadlow is the other guy who's done it in awake rabbits in a variety of cortical areas. And the cells do tend to fire at high rates for brief periods of time, and no one's looked at this question in the way that you're asking.
Going back to the question.
I mean, no one's taken natural spike trains and played them through. We could do it. We should do it.
You just showed me the thing shuts off after three spikes.
Right.
Had it hurt, it's all over. So it's like, boop, boop, boop. I mean, you can be going, but it's really going, boop, boop, boop.
Right. Now, of course, the other point that was raised on Monday is that these are data from a slice in the absence, presumably, of many, many modulators that change the release probability in the dynamics. So,
going back to the question, she asked you about similar orientations, etc., connecting to each other. You before talked about the barrels, and you kind of put in your data, but you said that within barrel, RS cells seem to be highly connected and not across barrels.
This is a paper by Dirk Feldmeier, I think. Recently. Did Dirk do that?
Okay, what about, you don't seem to have the same result with the interneurons, because...
Yeah. You could infer that the interneurons cross barrel boundaries. I don't know that for a fact. That's another experiment that should be done.
Just anecdotally, from your data, you said the RS...
I know.
Probability of...
No, your inference is right on. I thought about the same thing myself, but I... Without actually looking at the barrels and recording a cell here, a cell there, I'm going to be careful. There are other ways that might explain it. So should I? Are we going to break, or I can? I can just.
You know, I mean, in an ideal world, we break around 10:30.
Okay, that's fine. No, I.
There's a natural. We just reach a natural.
Well, so I have all this stuff on electrical synapses, which might actually be more interest to everybody. So I'll just plunge ahead. Break whenever you get tired. Okay, so that was all the more traditional kind of cortical connectivity. As a lot of you know, there's also another way that cells can interact, neurons can interact, and that's by so-called electrical synapses or electrical coupling or gap junctions, which are the morphological equivalent or morphological substrate for this. So I had to show some pictures of gap junctions. A gap junction is something you see in the electron microscope. And these are pictures from a paper that was published by Sloper and Powell back in 1978. Sloper actually had a short paper in 1973, I think, showing the essence of this. And the point is that and this was all done in monkey parietal cortex. They looked in the electron microscope, and what they found was that often enough, when they found two dendrites that were closely opposed like this, there was a specialization, which is well known to EM people, as the gap junction. Here's a blow-up of a gap junction.
Can you explain exactly what we see in those things? It's hard for me to read them.
Sure.
When those two things are dendrites.
These two things?
What are those two bubbles?
Yeah. So this is the perimeter of a dendrite. This is a dendrite cross-cut.
Okay.
These are mitochondria. This is another dendrite. And these are from neurons, and EM people somehow know that these are neurons and not glial processes. I mean, there's, 50 years of...
All mitochondria.
There are all sorts of hints about the filaments and everything else. I mean, there are other cells in the brain besides neurons. But based on lots of work, there are structural criteria to tell us that these are dendrites of neurons. So we'll take that on faith. Then the interesting thing is that if you look at the place where these two membranes come very close to each other, there is a specialization. In other words, there's a structure. It looks like this at higher power. The two membranes they look like they're touching, but instead there's this dark fuzzy stuff. And this is it. And that's called a gap junction. And it has a particular size and a particular spacing. And there's even, if you could look really closely, you'd see a periodicity to the particles in there. And all of this had been studied for decades, and so the structure of a gap junction was well known, both qualitatively as well as quantitatively. So the interesting thing here is that they found gap junctions between the dendrites of cortical neurons. And this is, as far as I know, the first, and for a long time was the only description of nice gap junctions. The other interesting thing was that they saw these gap junctions almost exclusively, in fact, maybe exclusively, between dendrites that were very sparsely spiny or mostly not spiny at all. Now, that's for cortical anatomists, that's a code word for inhibitory interneurons. The inhibitory interneurons tend to have very few spines or none at all. So what they were saying in the 1970s is that there ought to be electrical interactions via gap junctions between inhibitory cells in the monkey cortex. Yes?
What animal, what age?
This is in a monkey, a mature monkey. Mature monkey, right. So I'm not going to talk about development at all unless you press me here. This is certainly a mature monkey. And I don't remember the species, but.
What age were those slices?
Which slices? Yeah, okay. Well, I should have revealed that. Most of that is done in slices between 2 and 3 weeks postnatally in rats and mice. So those are not adults by any means. We've looked at them out to about a month, and at least the principles of what I told you don't change, but quantitatively I couldn't tell you. So that is certainly always an important issue for this kind of work. Just practically speaking, it's easier to do them in this kind of work in the somewhat younger animals. A lot easier. Oh, well, let me get to the data. I'll show you. You mean why didn't I show you electrical connections before?
No, I mean, before we were talking about kind of chemical synapses, looking at the interaction between.
Yeah, I'm going to answer your question in a few slides. The answer is that, well, I'll tell you now. Some of the cells, if you get two inhibitory cells, sometimes they have an electrical connection, but sometimes they don't. And sometimes they have a chemical connection, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have both. And there are times when you can block one with a drug and reveal the other. And that's what I'll show you. I'll give you all the numbers. Okay. All right. Just to complete the story, what is a gap junction? Well, we know a lot more about the structure of these things now. Gap junctions are made of these large proteins called connexins. Each cell contributes 6 connexins to make a connexon. So here's a connexon, which is a half of a channel. And when the membranes come together, 2 of these half channels mate and form. Actually, there is no name for this whole structure, but it's a 2-connexon system. And what it gives you is a very simple conduit, a channel between one cell and the other that interconnects the cytoplasm. It's just a large channel. Pore sizes tend to be fairly large. They let all inorganic ions that are important here through. They let a lot of small organic compounds through, some of them up to 1,000 molecular weight. Cyclic AMP, a number of signaling molecules can at least in principle pass through. Certain dyes can. So that's what a gap junction is. So it implies some continuity between the insides of 2 cells. And so a few years ago, as we did these pairwise recordings, we did notice that a fairly large number of interneurons were coupled to one another. So here's a couple of examples. This is my little symbol for the conductor, that is the gap junctional connection between the 2 cells. There are 2 FS cells and 2 LTS cells. And again, simple recording, and Carrie, here's a nice ramp. You put a current pulse, depolarizing or hyperpolarizing, into cell number 1, and you see a change also in cell number 2. So this is the hallmark of such a connection. Notice that the gains are different on the 2 traces. So there's a tremendous amount of attenuation of the voltage signal here to the voltage signal here. And I'll talk about that in a minute. A couple of other points. If you try to carefully measure the conductance in each direction, within the error, it's perfectly symmetrical. So these things seem to pass current equally well in both directions. There is no, that we've been able to see, no voltage dependence to the connection, which is interesting because some of the connexons do have a voltage dependence, a very slowly changing gating process. Attenuation is pretty strong, and we can define something that most people call a coupling coefficient. In other words, if we change the voltage here by 10 millivolts, how many volts do we get out here? And just look at the ratio. And the coupling coefficients are on average about 0.1, or a little bit less. So there's for steady state voltages, there's an attenuation of about 90% from cell 1 to cell 2. But you can see just by eye that faster events are attenuated much more strongly. You can define a coupling. Of course, the fastest event most neurons see is an action potential. And so you can define a coupling coefficient for the action potentials here, and those are about 0.01 on average. So a 100 millivolt spike in cell 1 gives you about 1 millivolt of a spikelet in cell number 2. What else? Interestingly enough, these cells don't readily pass some of the usual dyes that are used. If you've read about dye coupling experiments, the idea is to put a fluorescent or some kind of marker into one cell, allow it to diffuse through gap junction to other cells, and then you can see all the cells that are coupled to one another, at least within the sensitivity of the method. These gap junctions don't pass the usual dyes that are used, neurobiotin, biocytin, lucifer yellow. At least we haven't been able to get it to work, and as far as I know, no one else working on these cells has either. So.
Now, this is dendrodendritic, right? Dendrodendritic.
All the information is that converges on them being dendrodendritic or occasionally maybe dendrosomatic.
I was wondering how much of the attenuation is due to cable property.
Yeah, well, I'll get to that in a couple of slides too. Okay. So the first question we can ask is how often do we see these things? And the answer is pretty frequently if the conditions are right. And the conditions that you require are that the two cells be of the same type. So when we first observed this, we were very worried about artifacts, electrical sources of coupling, something completely non-biological. Well, one of the first things that made me pretty confident this was real is that it's cell type specific. So with rare exceptions, fast spiking cells couple only to fast spiking cells, and LTS cells, again, only to themselves. Yes? No, not necessarily. Based on the physiology, there's no way to know. And in fact, the bit of EM evidence that exists now suggests that you can often have more than one. There's often one, but sometimes you get multiple gap junctions between two cells. So, yeah, so for the most part, the coupling is only within each of the two inhibitory networks. And this is just a histogram or a cumulative plot of the junctional conductance based on the simplistic two-cell model where we're recording from a pair of cells. But it gives you some sense for the strength of these things. It's almost certainly underestimated. Maybe David Gollum will talk about this sometime down the line. And the other point is that when you do see one of these rare connections between a mixed pair of cells, it's almost always a very, very weak connection. So that reinforces the selectivity of this coupling. It's not only improbable, but it's weak. So we have coupling that somehow, to my mind, this might be the best definition for the distinction between these two groups of cells. The two kinds of interneurons somehow recognize one another and couple only with their kind.
Now you probably don't know the answer to this, given that previous question. If this was in a barrel, cross barrel.
Again, we haven't done that. And the last point is that the excitatory cells in our hands are never coupled to anything, including themselves. And that fits with the observations of most other people in these older cortical preparations, at least. The story may be very different at younger ages. Larry Katz and a few other people have stories about coupling at young ages. And by young now, I mean, say, the first postnatal week and before, embryonically, certainly. So it's much more coupling. Carrie.
Again, your question, the fellow who's asking, cross barrel. these are dendrodendritic. The dendritic fields of these cells are rather restricted in a vertical.
They tend to be vertically oriented. Yeah. We actually have.
So the what I was going to say, the opportunity for long range electric connections.
Absolutely. In fact, we do have some data that I'm not going to show, and maybe you'll talk about it sometime. But we have some data where we look at cells as a function. Actually, I'll show a little bit of it. As a function of distance and even as a function of orientation. Are they vertically spaced or horizontally spaced? And they are slightly more likely to be coupled if they're arranged this way than this way. But it's a fairly limited data set. So yeah, my own feeling about it is that obviously, if it's to the dendrites, there has to be opportunity. That is, the dendritic domains have to be overlapping. And the more they're overlapping, the more opportunity there's going to be. And in fact, I think, yeah, okay, so I did throw this in. So this shows some of the distance dependence of it. This is a very local process. This is actually a graph that David made. So this is distance. So the experiment here is to record from these pairs of interneurons at increasing distances and ask how coupling varies function of distance. So the likelihood of coupling drops off a bit. And actually, beyond 200 microns, we have no examples of coupled interneurons. The strength, in this case, in terms of coupling coefficient, that also drops off even more steeply with distance. And if you just take the product of the two, you have some sense for the magnitude of coupling. And the point is that the vast majority of the coupling is on a very local scale. 100 microns or less. Say again, sorry?
I don't know that you measure here only the electric coupling.
As opposed to?
Yeah, I know that the synapses are not active.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that totally, absolutely distinguish this kind of coupling. Coupling's a bad word because theorists tend to use it for what I'm going to call chemical synapses. Right, but those things tend to be unidirectional. They only go in one direction. Unidirectional between the two cells. A chemical synapse in the cortex, at least, only goes from one cell to the other. They're not polarized. You can't polarize them in both directions, and we can put drugs in that block the chemical synapses absolutely, and these things are still there. And so it's there's no real practical problem in telling them apart. This gets to what you were asking before, I think. I should have pointed out that these are not unlikely events. So again, if you have two cells within 100 microns of one another, there's an even chance, or even better, that they'll have an electrical connection. And I told you before that if they're two fast-spiking cells, there's about an even chance that they'll have a chemical connection, too. So there ought to be lots of cells that have both, and that's, in fact, true. And here's an example of that. Two fast-spiking cells that seem to have an electrical connection as well as a unidirectional inhibitory connection. If you evoke a spike in the first cell, it gives you a compound response. Consisting of a little electrical event, as well as an IPSP that follows with a somewhat longer delay, and truncates it and hyperpolarizes it. Vicuculine is a drug that blocks GABA A receptors, so we remove the inhibition, and you can see the pure electrical event in isolation. Well, this is where I'd like to take the discussion slowly. It's a little more complicated than that. Well, yeah, but I don't know that that's relevant.
You mean the fact that the
chemical
is not rectified,
right?
But in natural condition.
What I'm going to dispute is what you just said, that this electrical event is purely excitatory. And I'll show you why in a second. Okay, so the FS network, at least, it has both electrical and inhibitory connections, and that's got to give it some interesting properties. All right, I want to tell you a little bit more about the properties of the electrical connections, because we've studied these in some detail, and they turn out to be pretty simple. As I told you, they're symmetrical. There's no rectification. there is very strong attenuation. This is just a Bode plot. The experiment is to record from the two cells, inject sinusoidal currents into one, and then just increase the frequency of them and look at the attenuation you get. And these are data from groups of about 10 cells of both types, of each type. And they're normalized to attenuation you get at about 1 hertz, and you can see that the thing rolls off pretty steeply above about 10 hertz. Okay, so why? The answer is what David alluded to before. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. All right, so that's for sinusoidal currents. We can look a little more carefully at what the electrical PSP looks like, that is the postsynaptic response. And it turns out they're distinctly different in the two cells, or they're different in an interesting way. So here's two FS cells, and we evoke a spike in the first one, and this is what the electrical response looks like in the second cell. So of course it's strongly attenuated. This is 40 millivolt bar and a 1 millivolt bar. These are I think these are standard deviations for many, many trials in a single cell. And here you can see the action potentials a little better. They're spread out in time. You can see their time course. And the interesting thing to take away here is the difference between the two cells. So the fast spiking cell has a very rapid upstroke, or rapid depolarizing spike, and a larger and a more prolonged after hyperpolarization. And because of the frequency dependence of the connection, this part of the signal gets through pretty weakly. There it is. And this part gets through much more effectively because it's slower. So what you end up with is really a biphasic response. And that turns out to be partly excitatory, partly inhibitory if you test its effect on the postsynaptic cell. You don't see much of a... this one is mostly monophasic because the spike is more broad, the AHP is less prominent, and so you end up with a more protracted and more purely positive going electrical PSP. And then, of course, these are relatively fast conducting because there's no release process necessary here. Now, we've done some cable modeling of this. The question is, what accounts for the transformation between cell number one and cell number two? We've taken cells, we've stained them, we've reconstructed their dendrites, and we've built compartment. These are simulations in neuron using compartmental models of interneurons.
Before we get to the model, let me just understand. These are experiments on networks that are pretty quiet.
Yeah.
So if you're in cortex where there's a lot of activity, then if anything, the inhibitory cells are more shunted. So the numbers you have for the couplings are kind of upper bounds. It only get weaker if the cells are making connections on each other, then they're shunted.
That's not necessarily true.
I
don't dispute what you said, but I think it's only part of the story, because gap junctions, wherever they appear and wherever they've been studied, can be regulated both up and down by an enormous number of signal pathways. There are beautiful stories in the retina about how light adaptation changes the coupling between certain cell types. And so it could, I could also argue that in vivo, it may be that we're looking at, you know, the dregs of the coupling, that we've somehow taken this sick piece of tissue that we throw in under a microscope, and we're looking at the tiny bits of coupling that are left intact after we've abused the tissue. And that under normal conditions in situ, there's much more of this going on. So I don't know. I don't know where the truth lies.
For the total strength of the gap junction, the cell received from all the other cells, is comparable to the strength of the total weak current. So it's strong.
The weak current during activity? That's the point I'm raising. In slides. I'm just saying that, you know, during activity, that weak, what you call it weak, I mean,
it can be three times larger.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be conservative.
I'm trying to get a scale.
No, I understand. But so the flip side of the coin is that they could actually be stronger, and you know, until someone can measure it, we just won't know. There is some
But you said, but then I'm a little confused. I mean, just on the side, you said it's still, you know, there's no known agents that modulate.
No, I didn't say there are no, I said they're lousy drugs. There definitely are drugs that block them, but they're not specific. So for experimental purposes,
not specific to what else?
Well, so for example, we have found that you can block the coupling with octanol. Octanol is a long chain alcohol. Octanol blocks just about everything else in there, more or less. So we couldn't do what I was saying is we couldn't do the experiment that you were suggesting because we don't have a magic bullet that. We don't have a TTX for these channels.
But do you think that, but your notion is that there's yet to be discovered.
Yes.
Natural.
Absolutely. Everywhere else, gap junctions have been studied. And of course, most gap junctions are in non-neural tissues.
Right.
And they're regulated. They're regulated up and down, and their expression is regulated. And so yeah, I fully expect. And nobody's really published anything on this yet. I'll show you that. Yeah. So,
what's a lifetime of such a connected?
Lifetime in the sense of the protein turnover? Or, here I have, of course, no idea whatsoever. And in other systems, I don't know. You know anything about this?
I don't know. No, but, you know, not something I would expect to turn it over a lot.
Yeah, not in the course of an experiment. The cell, the connexins. Our connexons can be gated pretty rapidly.
Actually, I know I can say it must be days and days and days because I've seen a study showing the development and the growth of gap junction connections over time, where you get the connexons labeled at different times after, and you can see the junction forms in a series of rings from the inside to the outside, and the inside guys are still there days later when you're making them.
So, but what I was really getting to is that the gating can be altered by a variety of things very quickly. Connexins are very sensitive to internal pH, for example, and the pKa for that regulation is right around physiological pH. So if the pH of the thing shifted a bit, you could either kick the conductances up or the likely opening probabilities up or down. Because the thing sits right on the steep slope of the pH sensitivity curve.
Wait, so pH goes up, causes them to go down, causes them to close? Because if you get a calcium spike, I thought you get about a tenth of a unit of pH change.
A tenth?
That's what John Connor
said. That much? Acidification closes them.
Oh, so see, alkalinization
opens them.
Oh, I see. So activity, could, sign is such that activity would open them.
Could facilitate. Hey, that's a good one. So anyway, there are a lot of possibilities, a lot of uncertainties here. Okay, so not to dwell on this, but we did do some modeling. The question is, what accounts for the waveforms, the transformation of a spike from pre to postsynaptic cell in this case, and where are the gap junctions? And in fact, as we were doing this, there has been some morphological evidence from Gabor Tamás, that where they actually stained some cells, that these connections, as Sloper and Powell predicted, are between dendrites or dendrites and somata. But if you build the models, and these are simple passive models, two cells with more or less the structure of the interneurons, and this is one of the things we did here was just vary the placement of the electrical connection between the two. And everything's consistent with simple passive transfer from one cell to the other by a junction that is fairly proximal, that is fairly close into the soma. So for example, here's an FS cell. You drive the cell number one with the profile, the voltage profile of the fast spike, and you put the junction in over here, then you get these nice biphasic things of about the right size. Look very much like the experimental electrical PSP. And likewise with the LTS cell. So there's nothing magical about the connection or the dendrites that seem to interconnect the cells. It could be, and in fact, for a while we were excited by some work that Peter Jonas' lab published last year. In the hippocampus, there's the LTS-like interneuron, which is somatostatin positive. And they had a pretty paper in Science or Nature, which showed that And they did dendritic recordings from these cells, and they showed that these dendrites are incredibly axon-like. They have high densities of sodium, fast sodium channels, and in fact conduct action potentials about as well as any cortical dendrite I've ever seen. So there was the interesting possibility that LTS cells might be electrically connected through very excitable dendrites. But we have no evidence that that's the case here.
The FS cells not quite like the dendrites of the FS cells are not so active?
No one studied them. The problem is they're thin and hard to record from.
So maybe the idea of Straub and his colleagues that the neuron are coupled to axon is really between the dendrites of the LTS and axon-like activity.
No, I won't say it's impossible, but there's no evidence for it beyond Traub's models.
I mean, the reason for what Traub and Dragoon claim they feel that it's like I'm coupled in the axons,
yeah,
is because the dendrite is really type of an axon.
Yeah. Could be.
But would this be at all a threshold of both action potential like?
Well, you know, again, we talked about this yesterday. It would depend. If you made these very excitable, then, of course, the conductance of the connection is going to be very important, too. You have a big impedance load when it comes to... I mean, this might, if this is a too low a conductance, then, of course, you're going to squeeze out the current flow from one cell to the other. And in fact, the electrical PSPs are pretty small, suggesting that there isn't a lot of excitability that boosts them up from one cell to the other. But the point is here that the simulations are totally consistent with the absence of any boosting through nonlinear dendritic processes. This just shows that repetitive firing is also well modeled by this. Might be a good place to stop, take a break. So I'm not going to dwell on this story, but it's a newer story than the cortical stuff. But just to remind you a little bit about the anatomy, this is now a picture zooming in on that thalamocortical cortical slice that I showed you before. Here's the thalamus, or one corner of it. The relay neurons are here, and here's a cartoon of one. And of course, the relay neurons send axons up to the cortex, and that's where that one's going there. But at the same time, there is a shell of cells around the thalamus, around the relay nuclei, called the nucleus reticularis. Reticularis because it looks like a reticular. It's penetrated by all the axons that are going up and down, and so it has a reticular look to it. And this relay axon sends a little branch, a little collateral, into the nucleus reticularis, and it synapses on the cells in there. And the cells in there turn out to be all GABAergic interneurons, we can call them. They're the major or a major kind of inhibitory interneuron in the thalamus. And their input comes both from these relay axons, the little branches, as well as from the axons that go from cortex back to thalamus, which also drop, as they head back to the thalamus, they also drop a little branch into the nucleus reticularis. So this is a system of, the pink cells are a system of inhibitory interneurons that feed either backward or forward, depending on how you look at it, onto these relay neurons. And there's a large literature on the nucleus reticularis. Some people have even done some interesting modeling of this system. It's implicated in a wide range of functions, including rhythm generation and certain cortical EEG patterns, particular spindle rhythms. It's implicated in more global kinds of things, and I mean a wide range of things that I don't want to talk about, but there's, you know, going back to Francis Crick's idea about an attentional searchlight mediated by nucleus reticularis network somehow. The bottom line is that the functions of the nucleus reticularis are not terribly well understood. I think that's fair to say. Yes.
Not to dwell on this, because I know it's sort of controversial too, as to what the dynamics are, but have people recorded from nuclear reticular cells in awake animals of any species? You don't normally.
Mirce Steriod has some actually intracellular recordings that he's just now getting into papers from awake cats. He has this method that he's worked out lately where they can, they have chronically prepared cats. They do intracellular recordings in cortex and thalamus in a variety of places, and they're in Steriod's usual way. And they can do it in animals that are unanesthetized and that go through sleep-wake cycles. And I think he has at least one paper published just recently, and there will no doubt be many others coming quickly. But if you want to ask me, if you're asking me what the answers are, what they're doing, I don't know.
Right.
I don't think he has any NRT recordings published, at least.
He has not published in sleeping
animals. Yeah, well, anesthetized animals. Yeah, and you'd know that literature much better than me. Certainly, I think the best developed story for NRT is that it's implicated in spindle generation. And Steriod would say that, there are controversies about whether NRT networks alone are enough to generate spindles.
Right.
More people think that it's maybe an interaction between, that you need the interaction here between relay cells and NRT cells, but clearly they're implicated strongly in spindle rhythms. Spindles are a little EEG rhythm that is commonly seen in some of the lighter stages of sleep.
Which system do you look at?
Steriod looks in cats.
Which sound?
a variety, but mostly non-visual parts of thalamus.
Is NRT what you call NGN?
No, that's the medial geniculate nucleus.
Not NGN, what is it called? There's a different name for it in
RTN and RTN.
Yes, it's the in the visual system, it's the
PGN.
Perigeniculate nucleus. That's an extension of NRT.
Very strange cells.
Yeah, so that's an extension of NRT. So the bottom line is these are little inhibitory cells that feed into the relay nuclei. And all I really want to tell you here, and they're implicated in rhythm generation, among other things, is that those cells, those inhibitory cells, are also coupled to one another.
Do they fit in your previous categories of fast-like?
No. These are in a category of their own. They're more thalamic-like in that. You can see it in this one. So, for example, here's one. You hyperpolarize it, and there's a nice rebound burst, which is very characteristic of relay cells. Their properties are a little bit different from relay cells in some well-defined ways that people have studied. But they are thalamus-like in that they like to burst. If you hold the voltage in the right regime, they'll even give you repetitive bursts. So they're more they're a lot more bursty than any of the cortical interneurons that we've studied. But the message here is just that this other system of inhibitory cells down in the thalamus is also electrically coupled. The prevalence of coupling is a bit lower than we see in the cortex, but again, it's hard to quantify. So here's my canonical microcircuit, and it's not meant to be comprehensive, just covering the parts that I've talked about here today. But again, the major point is that electrical synapses are a prominent feature of the inhibitory networks in both the thalamus and the cortex. So if there's something novel in the last few years, that's the point. These reticularis cells are also supposed to be connected by inhibitory connections, but interestingly enough, in our paired recordings, we never once saw an inhibitory connection there. And it actually got us into a lot of trouble with some reviewers a few weeks ago, but we just didn't see them. Who did see them? No one has seen them directly. Yeah, his evidence is indirect. There's a lot of anatomical evidence that these exist. There are little axons in there. If you do EM, you can see chemical inhibitory synapses.
That little circle there, you've never seen.
We just never saw this one. I put it in. Why did I put it in?
No.
Because I believe it's there. at least in small numbers.
But David McCormick and Harris also didn't see any connection between RSA.
That's right. The anatomy, if you have any faith in anatomy, they must be there. The fact that we didn't see them is...
It may be really, really, really important.
It could be, yeah, I mean, there are lots of possible explanations. They're weak, they're very sparse, or they're widely dispersed. We only record from close-in cells. Maybe we're recording from... we're getting keyed into the fact that not all the cells are the same. Morphologically, there seem to be several categories, and we're getting the sense that only one of the categories has most of the coupling. I don't know. So I think they're there. We just haven't seen them yet.
So I mean,
it's just striking compared.
I mean, you find these, like, from an EM point of view, these symmetrical synapses between neurons, and then you convince the other parts.
Well, so there
only RTN cells in that region.
None of these, no single piece of evidence is definitive, because there is a sparse GABAergic projection into this nucleus from somewhere else in the brainstem. I don't remember where. But you can see little axons, little collaterals that arborize within NRT. There actually are some descriptions of dendrodendritic chemical asymmetric synapses, symmetrical synapses.
What's a puff gap on the cell?
But that doesn't help you at all, because every cell in the body responds to GABA, whether it has inhibitory synapses. I actually did my thesis work on dorsal root ganglion cells, and they're chock full of GABA receptors, and there's no synapse in the whole ganglion. So they express the receptors, I should tell you one other thing. The other reason I have this here is that if you massively stimulate extracellularly, you can evoke an iPSP in these cells. But again, I don't know that that's from axons within NRT or not. So it's just striking that if you record from pairs of these cells, and even pairs of these cells, you occasionally get inhibitory connections. But down here, we haven't seen it once, so it's odd.
So this is close to your heart, right? You wrote a paper once, right?
Okay. Well, and he's not alone. I can tell you the three reviewers of our recent paper also took this badly.
No, I didn't. Not the thing, of course, but what happened is that in 1993, we tried, John Rinzig and others, we tried to work very hard to make NRT neuron synchronizing the cause of chemical synapses. Had we known that, we wouldn't have done this work at all, because extra synapses are much more synchronized than any chemical.
Yeah.
Well,
we should have done this work a long time ago. All right. So
why didn't people notice?
No one to this day has done paired recordings from NRT except us.
No, I mean, but
McCormick, back, but unpublished.
Going back to neocortex.
It's the usual thing, that the technology wasn't there. I mean, the ability to... Alex Thompson is somebody who's been sticking pairs of cells in the cortex forever. 15 years, let's say, and doing it with sharp electrodes in the old-fashioned way, and it's just incredibly heroic work to do it that way. Now that you can see the cells, you can literally see them under the microscope, and you can do whole cell recording, and it's much quicker, and it just becomes practical.
Well, and when you can see them,
exactly. Yeah. So Alex's stuff, and the way I used to do it was all blind. So you're just sticking whatever you get, and what you get is mostly non.
From the top to the bottom of the slice is too far.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're mostly getting the cells you don't want. Okay. What I want to do for the this is just a cartoon. You should get David to tell you about some calculations he and Yael did about how the question is, how big are these coupled networks? And we don't have a direct answer. We can only infer from the density of cells and the distance dependence of coupling. But the short answer seems to be that one cell is coupled to a large number of other cells, in the cortex at least, tens of cells, which would imply that this is a continuous network that spans wide distances, although we have no direct evidence.
The question is whether there's some.
Well, there's definitely selectivity in that the fast spiking cells only couple to fast spiking.
No, I mean, with respect to feature detector columns.
Yeah, well, and that's really not something I can address right now because we're just.
What would the function be if everything synchronizes or everything is coupled to everything?
Well, that's. In the end, that's the question. Yeah.
Due to the strong attenuation, though, would you get anything similar to a diaphragmatic? You know,
oh, well, you know, so if we record from two cells that are directly coupled, a spike is attenuated 99%.
Right.
So if we talk about the next cell down the line, it's another hundredfold. So
even if they're connected to 10 others and somehow reconnect, would you get many?
Well, these are good questions for
you should be very careful.
Theory.
It's again, you're right. That even if they are 100 times attenuated, and each cell is coupled to 30 others, then it's not easy to neglect the non-direct connection. Especially when talking about steady state. And
I was thinking that they won't be that important just from looking at
actually,
that.
Actually, they are.
They are.
Especially to talk about, if you talk about steady state, they are important. Because in steady state, it's not 0.01, 0.1, 0.07 attenuation. The coupling coefficient is about 0.07. And if you have 30 connections, 20, then the indirect connections are really important. And the fact that when you measure, at least with this steady state experiment, you cannot never say whether the connections are direct or indirect.
Yeah, unless you stain the cells and do the anatomy, which is possible, but again,
are you going to talk about any dynamics in this network?
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about this connexin knockout, just because it's a useful tool. And then I'm going to finish up with what coupled networks might be able to do, or pairs of cells. So, all right, so a little bit of molecular work, just because it's a useful tool. This is actually, I think, David Spray's picture of the brain. Stars and stripes and bars and ellipses and first of all, what I want to do is spend a few minutes talking about connexins, these proteins that comprise gap junctions. Little red things here are the symbol for gap junctions, and the only point I want to make is that in the brain there are tremendous quantities of connexins, but almost all of them are in non-neural cells. Glial cells are coupled to each other. All of the supporting cells are coupled to each other. And if you strip all that away, there's a vanishingly small number of connexins that seem to connect neurons. But of course, that's what we're interested in today. I don't have the slide in here, but it turns out there's a wide range of connexin subtypes. So there are about 15, probably more now, connexin genes known in rodents and in humans. And again, you know, this is what it takes 12 of these things to make one gap junction. The molecular biology, this is all well developed in non-neural tissues, but it's known that you can take connexins and often these things are homomeric and then homotypic, meaning that one connexin type makes up a whole channel. You only use one connexin type. It is possible to get interesting functional combinations of heterotypic and heteromeric connexins that can give you different properties. But one interesting question is, what's the connexin that's important in the systems I've been talking about? I'm going to make this story pretty short. In the last year or two, we collaborated with David Paul's lab at Harvard. His student Michael Dean's made a knockout mouse of one of the connexins called connexin 36. Now, connexin 36 is particularly interesting because it's the first and, to some extent, I think still the only one that people feel is exclusively neuronal, exclusively expressed by neurons and not by other cells, at least in the brain. Whereas a lot of the connexins are expressed by glia as well as neurons. There's more and more evidence that connexin 36 is only between neurons. So this mouse, excuse me?
Are there others that are between neurons?
There are said to be others between neurons. The data are soft so far. The mouse is, so the mouse has a connexin 36 gene deleted. In its place, it expresses a couple of different marker proteins. One of them is beta-galactosidase. So this is a stain for the marker protein for the connexin 36 promoter, presumably. And I just want to point out that in the cortex, what you see are scattered, it's a bad picture, but you see scattered cells. And in fact, with double labeling, most of these cells double label for either parvalbumin or somatostatin, although there are some that don't stain for either. And there are some that stain for parvalbumin and somatostatin that don't stain for beta-galactosidase. But there's a reasonably large population of cells that do double stain. It doesn't seem to be staining the pyramidal cells at all. There's a lot of it in NRT. There's almost none of it in the relay nuclei. And the short answer is that when you take the knockout animals and you slice them up, first of all, in the wild types, you see, this is all mouse, of course. Everything I showed you before is from rat. But the wild-type mice have essentially the same numbers of coupled cells, same prevalence, same strength, as you see in the rats. And when you look at their knockout littermates, you find essentially no coupling between interneurons, either in the cortex or in the thalamus, in the NRT. Yes? Sorry?
Do you actually need interneurons? I mean, do you need these
Do you need them for life? It's always the first question. And the answer is they're perfectly viable. The brains look normal, I mean, by any way that's been, anatomically that is. They don't have any obvious neurological deficits. More than half of all random knockout mice have a seizure disorder, for example. There are two parts to this answer. One is that to the eye, they look fine. They even breed, which is probably the most high-level mouse behavior. But the other part of the answer is that they haven't yet been studied in any detail. There are people studying these in a whole wide range of behavioral tests and learning paradigms. And people have looked at theta rhythms a little bit. And nothing's been published. Word on the street is that I haven't heard yet of anybody who's found a deficit. But and we're looking a bit ourselves.
And they're not seizure prone.
There's no obvious seizure disorder, but seizures can be very hard, not obvious to the eye in a mouse.
But I mean, there's a different EEG, no? There's a different EEG.
According to whom?
No.
I don't know yet. I don't know. This is a work in progress, and I have, if I have faith in anything, it's that these mice have some sort of problem, but it will be interesting to see. It's nice that they don't die because we can study them. But if they don't have some sort of...
I don't want to sound like a lecture at an undergraduate level.
But go right ahead.
They may be able to compensate quite nicely for the lack of by turning up the strength of their inhibitors.
So this is a general problem with knockouts, and you know, eventually it would be nicer to have a knockout that you can, it's conditional, and you can turn it on at a certain time. This is an animal that's grown up without this gene, and this is the common problem. So what I can tell you, though, is that unlike a lot of other knockouts, that there's no obvious anatomical change in these animals. The physiology of the cells is essentially identical. The chemical synaptic connections are in the knockouts are essentially the same as they are in the wild type. Come on, these are just a couple of examples. I'll show you the numbers. There's no measurable change in either the number of inhibitory connections you see, or their strength, or their dynamics. So if there's compensation, it's not anything we've measured yet, but of course you can't measure everything. To the extent that any of us have looked at this, it seems to be a pretty selective loss of the electrical coupling, and not much else has changed that's obvious yet. And it's gone in the thalamus too, and then the coupling between the NRT cells is gone. All right, now what I want to do is get to what coupled groups of cells can do, and I'll come back to the knockout, because the knockout's a tool, of course.
This is just neurons. This is not the same gap junction among the astrocytes.
That's right.
The epithelial cells.
That's right.
So the
So there's the best evidence for the location of these proteins is a guy at Colorado named John Rash who does, I don't know how this works, but there's the easiest way to see gap junctions is with freeze fracture electron microscopy. You know how this works? You fix and freeze the tissue and then you crack it. And it tends to fracture through lipid bilayer planes. So lipid bilayers split apart. And then you can look now at the surface, and gap junctions are very clear by the particles, clusters of particles. So he's done this coupled with immunocytochemistry. So he can use antibodies to look for different connections. And the bottom line is that connexin 36 in a variety of places in the brain, he only finds it at gap junctions between neurons. Whereas he's looked at several of the other connections, and those only happen between non-neurons. 43 is all between astrocytes, and there's another one that you tend to see between oligodendrocytes. And so it's looking like 36 may be an exclusively neuronal marker. Okay, so the last part of the talk is how some of the work we've done on how gap junctions might mediate interactions between cells. And the first one, first example I'm going to show you is, this was published last year, but I'm sure no one read it. But it's some work where we take the LTS network and we jazz it up. We get it excited with specific agonists. I'll remind you that the LTS network is a strongly coupled network, but has very few inhibitory connections within it. So we're looking for a way of turning on the LTS networks exclusively. And the way we do that is to use a number of drugs. In this case, ACPD, which is an agonist of metabotropic glutamate receptors. And it turns out that it's the mGluR1A subunit that's important here for those who care. You can also use agonists of muscarinic acetylcholine receptors. They give you essentially the same result. And the result is that when you put these drugs on, it gets these LTS cells, it causes them to depolarize, and they start firing like crazy. And the other cells pretty much sit there. The excitatory cells are actually a little bit inhibited by this stuff. And the FS cells, most of them do nothing. A couple of them might depolarize a little bit. But this is a fairly selective way, as far as we can tell, of turning on the LTS network. Right. Yeah. So here's a pair of cells in the presence of ACPD, and you can see that they're firing along pretty strongly. And this is very common. There's a period where they fire in a very irregular pattern, and then they'll just quickly and spontaneously switch into a more bursty pattern. And the patterns are very complicated. You wash in the drug, and the cells go up. They start firing irregularly, then they go into this burst mode, and then they might shut off for a few seconds, and then they come up and they do it again. And we don't understand why, what mediates these different patterns. And David and I were talking yesterday about what might cause this irregularity. The answer is I don't know. But what I want to do is show you what happens. What's going on within the network of LTS cells. So you can see already with your eye that there's a lot of synchrony here, especially when it falls into these bursting patterns. The two cells are bursting at more or less essentially the same time. If you look a little more closely, just spread this out, it's not just that they're bursting together, but there's some very fine-grained synchrony between the spikes. And here are some cross-correlograms. So this is a cross-correlogram during this more irregular period, say from here to here. This is a cross-correlogram during the bursty period. So not only are the cells firing, I mean, the action potentials are coming at very precisely timed, precisely timed relationships to each other. Maybe that's not so surprising. This is an electrically coupled network.
But how far apart are they?
These are very close. And yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about the distance dependence of it all. Yeah, so these are cells that are very close to one another. I think in this case, but they don't necessarily have to be coupled to one another in order to get, you get the best, you certainly get the best, tightest coupling if they, or synchrony if they are coupled to one another. Okay, so we've got a way of turning on globally the LTS network in a fairly selective way. couple of points. You don't need any chemical synapses in order for this to work. So here's an experiment where we put in blockers of AMPA receptors, NMDA receptors, and GABA-A receptors. And then you throw ACPD on, and it all works the same. Or at least in the LTS cells, you get the same firing patterns.
Fast chemical.
Right. Because the metabotropic receptors.
I guess what we could go back one slide. So, I mean, thing on the it's a little bit curious comment about fast. It's a little bit about this comment about fast synapses. I mean, this, look at the cross correlation. It looks like you have to go way, way out in time until it decays. Right? I mean,
look at this correlation.
Here?
The correlation is there. So bells are pretty much correlated over a long time. But spikes are not.
No, I get your point. How long do you have to go in time until...
Till these fall off?
Until the bumps fall off.
I don't know. I mean, we didn't look that far. The problem is these things are not stationary. You know, they'll go into this bursting mode for a few seconds and then it quiets down. And there's some very slow modulation.
That's things like seconds.
It's seconds.
It's huge correlation time.
Yeah. It's a few seconds.
Did you also plot the do we have the picture of the autocorrelation function of the phase?
I don't have a picture of that.
How irregular the
right.
Neuron spiking, I mean.
Yeah, we haven't done that, but that would be fun to try. All right. So you don't need fast chemical synapses for this process. And the other thing that we're doing in this experiment is to now we inject it's an LTS pair again. ACPD has excited them. We inject current to hyperpolarize them to turn the spikes off. So we're going to look at what's going on subthreshold. And this is what's going on. There are lots of these little spiky events that go up and down. In a close pair, the subthreshold voltages are incredibly well correlated too. So here's the cross correlation of the voltages in a coupled pair or in a close pair. So again, that makes sense too. If you can imagine this large network of LTS cells, they're all excited by the drug, they're all firing, and they're electrically coupled. They're pumping current into their neighbors, and they're interacting via that, and there's a close correlation between that. Yeah.
So when you have this correlation subthreshold,
which work in monkeys? In cats.
Cats, sorry.
Yeah. So two things. First of all, their work is, they're almost certainly not recording from LTS cells because they're doing the traditional blind recording, and the odds of that are vanishingly small. But second of all, does this result account for the synchrony they see? Maybe. So let me take it one more step. So this is what the LTS...
I have another question, though, before that. The LTS cells are most, they don't have much hyperpolarization, is that correct?
They have some, yeah.
But less. So
yes.
Mostly what they get here under these conditions is excitation from other LTS cells.
Under these conditions, there's the drug. Well, so we don't know how mGluR1A receptors affect these cells. In other cells, they almost certainly, they have effects on a variety of channels. And so presumably they're boosting up some and suppressing others, and they're changing the membrane properties in ways that we haven't even begun to study.
I was just wondering why it doesn't become completely epileptic.
Well, the cortex doesn't become epileptic because, as I'll show you in a second, these are inhibitory cells, of course, and their only output is inhibitory.
Yeah, but
in a sense, you could say the LTS network is epileptic.
Under the drug condition, right, you shut off the GABA.
Yes.
Right. So
yeah.
Within themselves, they
well, the cells. ACPD inhibits the excitatory cells, so if anything, it's anti-epileptic.
Right, but just look at the subnetwork. You have a subnetwork of only inhibitory cells, but you've shut off their inhibition to each other, and they don't LTS don't inhibit each other anyway. So if you really had this isolated subnetwork of LTS cells that are GABA GAP junction connected, they will excite each other.
And they do.
What?
And if you want to call this,
sometimes more inhibitory than
salutary. You cannot say that. Well, but the thing is that's what I was talking about the AHP. If they don't have a strong AHP, then mostly an action potential on one will cause an excitation of another.
You have to be careful. There's a delay time. I think you can't. I think the lesson is you can't think of a synapse as just a sign. You have to think of it also. It has a time constant. If the thing is oscillating at a frequency, depending whether. I think crudely, things are getting in phase or...
Well, and the other thing...
affects whether it's going to excite or
not. Yeah, certainly. But in this context, too, once you put on ACPD, it's not the same membrane it was before anyway, because it's a... This is well known in other cells to affect a variety of currents. So it's a different cell. And you know that, obviously, it depolarizes and it fires in interesting ways. And we just don't know what the how the cell has been changed. Okay, so we have an LTS cell.
Is there a condition to isolate these LTS cells such that can
physically
the action of the drug on an individual neuron?
No. Not in any simple way.
An isolated cell would go through this.
Yeah, I mean, we could, in principle, you can take the slice and you can treat it with enzymes and you can knock all the cells apart and one could look at a single cell and that hasn't been done. Okay, so it's an inhibitory network, let's not forget. And so we would expect that the LTS cells, once they're firing away, should inhibit these guys in a predictable way, and the answer is that they certainly do. So if you do a pair, say, of that cell and that cell, every time the LTS cell network bursts, you get a nice phasic period of inhibition in the FS cell. And the same thing, and because neighboring cells, output cells, are being driven by the same LTS network, you would expect correlations in the inhibition. And in fact, it's incredibly well correlated, again, at a close spatial scale.
And this is close to the reversal potential for chlorine.
Well, to make these measurements, we've held the membranes at a standard resting potential and a more depolarized one, so we can see the IPSPs well. So the message here is that when you activate these things with, and these are not exotic drugs; they're activating natural receptors. And it's, glutamate will also activate the mGluR receptor by definition. Acetylcholine also gives you a similar result. But you can activate this network with these agonists. They fire together. They fire in various patterns, both irregular as well as rhythmic. And then they impose that pattern in the form of inhibition on essentially the entire local network, the FS cells as well as the excitatory RS cells. And I think I threw in one more. Oh, okay. So the question arose, everything I showed you was from very closely spaced cells. And it's of great interest to know exactly how far, spatially, what's the domain over which this thing works. And the best data we have involve making paired recordings from the output cells. So namely, you record from a pair that includes one or both of each of these. So you're looking at the inhibition. Now you record from cells that are farther and farther apart, and you get data that looks something like this. Come on. So these are recordings of two excitatory cells, and we're looking at the IPSPs that impinge on these cells. And in this case, the cells are very close, 10 microns apart.